Welcome to Ain't Slayed Nobody. This is an actual play podcast intended for adults and may contain material that some people find disturbing. Please see the episode notes for content warnings and listen with care.
Okay, we are back getting ready to kick off an extended night phase. But before we do that, a little bit of housekeeping, and then we're going to check in with some unresolved aspects of the Janus mask, the housekeeping bits. So one thing we want to note is that because you marked a mask of the past, Mr. Kessler, in order to not wolf out during the quickening, you are instead going to get a 7 to 9 on that roll, which means you are going to be drained for this phase and possibly longer, but definitely for this phase.
Okay.
I did want to check in on the Selkie, this move that you do, which is Moonlight Upon the Waves. And it says that the darkness is far safer for London's animal life. You are no exception. During the dusk phase, you can choose to do it. It sounded like you were last time, if I'm not mistaken. And then at the start of the night phase, you put on your pelt and take to London's waters in the form of a seal. There's some other little things. You do get to choose two boons and one complication from the list below. I think I'd like to know what those are now, if that's okay, just so I can start thinking about them.
Okay, great. Yeah, so why don't we find a clue? And maybe because it seems kind of fun and involves one of you, maybe I'll find a keepsake?
Okay, I like that.
I ask another hunter what it is for my personal quarters. And then for the complication, I was thinking a creature of the deep demands a favor in return for their help.
Ah, good. Okay. I like that very much. And let's see if there's anything else housekeeping-wise. I mean, yeah, just to be quickly reminded, you actually have 4 active threats, but 2 of them no longer have questions to answer. They just need to be resolved. The St. James Street Ghost, the Limehouse Lurker, I think we're going to have a stab at that tonight. Last time, we did not introduce the unseen that we're going to be doing for this night phase. So we'll do that in a moment. But I think before we even get to that point, I think I'd like to just go back to the dusk and talk about the Mask of the Unquiet. The Mask of the Unquiet is something that you all have to do. Each hunter narrates a flashback to their childhood when they experienced a haunting.
I figured it's dusk. So I think we're all at the Hargrave house kind of getting ready to go out for the night. And maybe we just kind of all run into each other in like the common area before we head out. Well, I think because of the St. James Street ghost, maybe we're just talking about our own stories from the past about, well, this isn't the first time I've seen a ghost.
Well, of course, it's not the first time you've seen a ghost. We've been dealing with a ghost for the last few weeks.
Right. No, I just mean like as an adult, it's the first time I've seen a ghost, but I've also seen a ghost, you know, back in America. So it's kind of fun, I guess, to get back into it.
What sort of ghosts do you have in America? Are they particularly boorish?
Judgment.
Well, I didn't get to know my ghost too well, but, you know, trying to remember back, I think I was probably 9 years old and got away from the main house and started to head out toward the gardens. It was a full moon, if I remember correctly. I came up on this little well that I'd never seen before, and it had been boarded over, and I heard a sound coming from down in the well. It was kind of a pleasant sound. It was like water rolling over stones. But then I made out a giggle. So I got real close and kind of tried to look between the cracks in the boards. And I heard a voice, right? And it said, "Daddy? Daddy?" And I just kind of looked around and I started talking to the ghost, but it wouldn't answer me. It was just crying out for daddy. And it wasn't panicked at first, but then it really picked up and started to scream. So I ran back to the house and I started talking to one of my older sisters. And she said, don't go back to that well, because your older brother fell into that well before you was born. And I never knew about the older brother. So it kind of shook me.
That was your brother speaking to you?
I believe it was.
Why was he asking for your daddy?
I don't know. Whenever we get in trouble, we go to daddy, right?
Did you never go back?
No.
You left your brother there?
Well, that's one way to put it. I was 9 years old. I was scared. Right? Shit, maybe I should have gone back.
Do you suppose he's still there?
We need to get on a ship.
He might have helped you, you know? Not all spirits are scary or bad, and we interacted with them in the waters all the time. We always knew there was channels we would navigate, and there was one in particular when I was very young, I remember, with my friends. We were a bit lost, but then suddenly we could hear the whispers of all the Selkies past, sort of warning us not to go one way, and the waters became freezing suddenly, and it stopped us in our tracks. And we always knew that those were voices and whispers to be listened to. I'm not one to always set aside something just because it's a ghost or a spirit. I feel like humans are quick to push them aside.
Well, I left something out. I think I was scared to find out exactly what happened. I would have gone back, but my sister kind of hinted at the fact that maybe Daddy had something to do with him falling in that well.
Ghost? I mean, that seems like an obvious assumption. Oh. Why else would he be saying Daddy and not anyone else? Just anyway.
Thanks, Ms. Archer. That gives me a comfort, yeah.
Of course. My pleasure. I was simply going to ask Ms. Innes if the ghosts of her ancestors, kin, I don't know, if they always protect you.
I think it's not quite as easy on ground. I certainly don't hear my grandmother's voice as often anymore. I do miss it. But I like to think they must still be out there. Well, it's why I like to take to the waters when I can. Do your ancestors not speak to you?
Oh, I suppose in a way they do. It's more the living that affect my life. The living relatives, I suppose. I do not mind ghosts so much as I've had much experience with them. In fact, my family was of the strong belief that exposure is the best way to get over fear. And so, delightfully, they at one point decided it was time to expose my brother and I, and they sent us to a little cabin where several gruesome murders have taken place and are still visited by the spirits. And those happen to be particularly the ones that can assess your fears and show them to you. It was a long evening and night, but we survived, and we were stronger for it.
That sounds dreadful.
What parts of life aren't?
Oh.
I find myself far more sympathetic towards Mr. Kessler's perspective on the whole thing.
Thank you. I was 9 years old.
Ghosts can be quite tiresome, and I think they're best ignored, unless they have something interesting to offer, as I believe our friend at St. James's Street does. But I must admit I did experience something of a haunting when I was a child, a similar in kind of age that Mr. Kessler described. It was shortly after I was adopted by my new family, and I found myself being disturbed by strange noises around the house, and I woke up a couple of times to find the shape of a young boy standing there in my room watching me as I slept and creeping around the place. I suppose it was unsettling in its way, but I'm happy to report that we did manage to get to the bottom of it in the end, and it turned out that it wasn't a ghost at all, that it was a child who claimed he used to live there, but I had a word with mother and father and they drove the urchin out, and, well, that was that. All happily resolved in the end.
It bothered you that he was watching you?
It didn't bother me that he was watching me. I'm quite used to people watching me. I just found it a bit unsettling that he was creeping around the place. Like some kind of rat in the night.
Interesting. Interesting coming from you, Mr. Melmoth.
I'm going to go play billiards.
All just awkward silence at the end of Mr. Melmoth's story.
Miss Innes, your haunting was beautiful. So thank you for sharing that story with us. The murder shack has me a little creeped out, Miss Archer.
I think that is an appropriate reaction for someone who is not prepared necessarily to deal with creatures of this type.
I was 9, so maybe now I could. Yeah, okay.
I think that you need to stop relying on your age as your excuse for this one. Were you 9 every time you passed by the well?
Oh, I never went out to those gardens again. I mean, the estate is sprawling. It's very easy to avoid different areas.
You left the spirit of your murdered brother to just sit there. You never gave him company even, a chance to speak to someone from a life that was robbed of him. How could you?
Right.
It's a nice well. The stonework was beautiful. Are there worse places to spend an eternity?
It sounds like you couldn't get out.
I was 9.
Well.
I'm sure I'll go back someday.
I'm glad you're not 9 anymore.
Me too.
I agree. It does sound as though he would be particularly ineffective if he were 9.
Okay.
I'm just joking. Convivial, kind of like punch on the shoulder. You see, we all have something in common. We were all traumatized by the ghosts of our past.
Oh, that's fun, yeah.
Yes, yes. Well, anyway.
I wouldn't quite say I was traumatized.
Nor was I.
Oh, true.
Oh, the whole thing was rather tiresome, really.
Speaking of tiresome, I do have to attend to some business related to that letter that you all read before I got home.
Right. I feel like it's as everyone's dispersing, as they're walking away, that Moira is like, oh, I've only been traumatized by the living.
Fantastic. We are heading into our night phase. Our unseen is going to be Saint Osana's home for the destitute. I'll remind you that your goal in the night phase with the unseen is to create thematic or visual or sensory connections between the two scenes, the hunter scenes and the unseen, in order to get an echo in the night, which is worth an experience point. Saint Osana's home for the destitute. Saint Osana's is a modest-sized workhouse with around 300 inmates. The cramped, unsanitary accommodation is segregated by age and gender, with families separated except for babes in arms. The food is meager, the work frequently pointless, and the discipline harsh and arbitrary. After lights out, the house is silent, but for muffled sobs and snatches of whispered conversation. Let's paint the scene first. What signs do we see that this place is not just pointlessly cruel, but deliberately so?
There's a bathroom off of the main sleeping dormitory area, but it has been locked. And instead, there are just buckets in the main dorm, one with water for bathing and the other that's just for, you know, for other stuff. And neither one is changed very often.
Disgusting.
there's a table that's just torture tools, torture instruments like an Iron Maiden and thumb screws and a tongue tearer, things like that.
An Iron Maiden?
Jesus Christ.
Sure, why not?
We see a group of like the guards in the back in some sort of like alleyway, and they're taking some of the products that they've made and just like balling it up and burning it, just like putting it to waste because it's not anything they ever intended on using. It's just keeping these people busy and putting them to work.
Wow, that's good.
The workhouse itself is almost entirely undecorated. There are no paintings or pictures or anything to cheer the place up. The only thing that gives the walls any character is over the doorway to the children's wing. There is just in gold stencil or gold leaf over the top of it, "Spare the rod and spoil the child."
Ooh.
Miss Viola Archer, how do we see you at the start of this night phase as you're getting ready to meet Ms. Welk at Cremorne Gardens for your off-delayed evening out of dancing? How are you dressed? How are you preparing? What's going on?
So she's, again, just going to wear the same clothes that she wore during the day. I think that the most prominent feature of it is just kind of this almost ankle-length duster, you know, that's very structured because it needs to have places to hide things. And she's basically, instead of like primping and prepping, the way that she gets ready for an evening is if she knows that she's going to be in relative contact with, like close contact with someone, or if she knows that she's going to be in like enemy territory, she moves some of the weapons into more hidden places. Like she kind of like readjusts the pins and kind of like, okay, instead of having the holsters on the hip for knives, now they're going to go in boot. And you know, she's just kind of like moving weapons around.
I like it. Mr. Kessler, how are you preparing for your night of gambling? And or you said you're going to go play billiards, right, for money?
Yeah, at the hotel. I think that I probably would have caught up with Sebastian to get recommendations for clothing because I'm trying to look like a man of leisure instead of an obvious American. Do you have something I can borrow?
Certainly not.
I just want to fit in. I think it would really help me if you could at least advise me. How can I put my own clothes together in a way that would work?
Mr. Kessler, what about me makes you think that I have any interest in fitting in?
That's fair. That's fair. So he's going to dress like a cowboy. He's going to head to the hotel and try to be charismatic, entertaining, kind of casual, confident American walking into the billiards room or billiards hall, whatever they have.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Melmoth, how does one dress for an evening of hanging out with a ghost?
He's wearing a tailored suit that is made of a fine material, maybe satin, that is a sort of charcoal color that catches the light in interesting ways. He's wearing a waistcoat underneath that, an open-necked ruffled shirt, and of course his cape. Nothing too ostentatious, nothing that's going to get in the way of the evening's business.
Ms. Innes, how does your night start? What does it look like when you take to the waters?
She wants to be inconspicuous. She's not very good at being inconspicuous. I think she only owns very light-colored, bright dresses. So she's got one of those on, but she's like taken a cloak, I think maybe from Miss Archer's closet, and has like draped it over herself, is trying to keep herself covered as she kind of tries to keep to the alleyways and to find a remote area by the Thames that she could jump into. But she does need somewhere to leave her clothes and retrieve them when she does come out. So she tries to find somewhere that has like a safe little rock to place things under that hopefully no one will disturb or take when she gets out.
I love it. That's really good, actually. So, Ms. Archer, you're at Cremorne Gardens, and at night, it's very different than it is in the day. At night, it is absolutely crammed with people. In the day, it's very, like, casual. There might be a couple of little events going on, but mostly it's just couples and families, maybe individual idlers, sort of just strolling among the gardens and things. But at night, there are gas lamps lit all over, giving the place like this sort of green glow. And there are huge numbers of people, just people, like clutches of people everywhere. And in particular, the dancing platform, it's enormous. It's a colossal pagoda-shaped structure crammed with revelers. There are hundreds of lanterns glowing overhead. The dance floor has been scuffed by thousands of pairs of shoes. And there are just hundreds upon hundreds of people crammed in here dancing. Let's paint the scene, everyone. The dancing platform has a sense. There's a sense of wild abandon, of unshackling of the social constraints of the day hanging in the air in this place. What do we see or otherwise perceive that shows this unshackling?
The ties are loose, the bows are loose, the jackets are open. The hair not quite as like perfectly kept. People are, you know, physically, literally looser in their appearance.
Sitting in a bush just to the side of the dance floor is a discarded petticoat that one of the dancers obviously found too constricting at some stage.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. There's something almost like, not primal, but kind of approaching it, about the sound of like the shoes on the wooden platform. Like, it's like very unusually like rhythmic and resonant, and like that's almost overtaking the music, but like it seems to be feeding people just like that driving rhythm.
The dances themselves are unorthodox and probably promiscuous and kind of risque.
Oh my
They're doing the lambada.
I don't even know what that is.
It's the forbidden dance.
Mr. Kessler, energies are high at the Langham at night as well. As we described last time, the Langham Hotel it's a fairly new hotel, and they are really, really putting their best foot forward to attract like the best clientele. And so everything is polished and perfect, and the service is prompt and well lit. It's magnificent. I think for purposes of triggering your As Cruel as the Harlot's Curse move, you may need to take the reveling somewhere. You may need to take the game somewhere a little seedier, a little darker, a little. This is sort of the opposite of the dark and seedy underbelly.
I see. Yeah.
That said, we can start here, though. And I really want to see like the sort of like the showman, Mr. Kessler, because you were kind of like a showman in some sense. You were at least like putting on a performance informally, if nothing else. What is that like? Like, how does this billiard game get going?
I think, and this may work for triggering the Harlot's Curse later, I think he's going to act in a way that could possibly get him kicked out of an establishment like this.
Ah, very good.
When he kind of struts in and, you know, puts his shoulders back and he sees this man in a tailored suit kind of holding a pool cue out to the side, he just snatches it out of his hand and then walks to the other side of the table and takes a shot in the middle of their game. You know, he sinks it, but it's like everybody's like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, he's trying to look really cool about it. And then he's going to say, oh, man, I used to play a whole lot of pool back at home. And I imagine he's getting the eye rolling.
Mm-hmm. For reasons not the least of which is I think they would call it snooker in London at this time, but maybe not.
Right, but back at home it was pool.
I love it. Mr. Melmoth, the energy couldn't be more different at 18 St. James's Street. You know, last time we described how the shell that is 18 St. James's Street, the very terrible vibes it's giving off now, given that the family's no longer there, the ghost is fully in control. And I think that it's that sort of sense of creeping death, of spectral sovereignty, has reached out into this whole neighborhood, the whole street. You'll notice it as soon as you come upon the street, Mr. Melmoth. And here I'd like to paint the scene. as we extend the ghost's influence beyond the house, beyond Constance Head's house, out into the street, out into the square, out into the maybe a nearby park, how can we tell? How do we know the ghost is settling in over everything?
All the plants in everyone's front gardens have just started wilting and dying.
I was going to do a plant thing as well. The like hedges and bushes that surround the house, their roots and any kind of like creeping vine parts of it have like extended out, and it almost looks like a network of like veins running across all of the like the surfaces of the neighborhood.
Inexplicably, in the air around the neighborhood where this begins, it's almost like it doesn't smell this way, but almost like when there's a gas leak and it you're unwell from just breathing in that air, there's some level of unease, something in the air that makes you uncomfortable as you move through it.
I think in the neighboring houses, or at least the houses that are within eyeshot of this one, people are just standing in the windows staring at the house. It's like they can't break their gaze.
Miss Innes, I like to imagine that your people understand and experience water in a very different way than other people do, right? Mm. And that maybe there is this idea of like the water of a place somehow reflecting or carrying the impressions, the memories, the vibes, the spirits of that place, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I want to just wrap up this first little bit of the night phase by asking you, what do these waters tell you about London right now?
Ooh. Like, I think in the waters themselves, because I think that that's where she can almost feel the spirits of the working class, those that are upon it, and that there's this struggle to keep afloat, and that there's a lot of discarding happening, right? Like, there's literally a lot of pollution in these waters, and it is almost choking at times and thick and hard to get through certain areas of the Thames. And yeah, I think she can just feel the struggle of London in these waters.
Before we head back to St. Osana's, I want to say that that sailor who we haven't seen for a little bit, but who has been watching you from the shadows, Miss Innes, we see that sailor walk up to the rock where you put your clothes, and he's lifting the rock to see what you put there. And with that, we shall go back to St. Osana's home for the destitute. Nick, Cedric Decker is a boy of 11. His father was a wealthy wine merchant until gambling landed him in debtor's jail. As Cedric lies in his bed in the boys' wing, how do we see his sheltered upbringing has not prepared him for this place?
So, it's a couple of things. First, at bedtime, this boy has been pampered his entire life. He's never really had to lift a finger. And so he doesn't totally know how to get himself ready for bed. He ends up just watching what the other people are doing, but he's got his dressing gown on backwards, and, you know, there are a bunch of little things that are wrong. And his staring and his obvious lack of comfort with this entire situation, he doesn't know to hide that. And so he is an easy target. He's easily identified as a target by some of the more kind of like aggressive bullies of the boys' room or the boys' area. And so one of the first nights that he arrives, he gets a little bit of a hazing where he is tied down to the bed and, you know, a strap put across his mouth to keep him from screaming as they go to work on him and beat him up a little bit.
Ms. Archer, there is a hue and cry coming up from the crowd. Are you on the dancing platform at this point? Like, have you at least made your way up there? Or are you watching from a ways back?
I think it's going to be watching from a ways back. What I'm picturing is that Viola walks up to the entrance of the gardens, sees this mass of humans and all these lights, and she kind of like rolls her eyes and turns around and then goes to like the side. You see her like scaling a fence or something and kind of landing in the shadows. And I think she's going to make her way to the dance floor via the like behind the tents, a route that is mostly in shadow and meant for people that like mostly work there. And she'll just be observing for a little bit to try to get a lay of the land and to see if Ms. Welk is already there.
Make the information move. You can make it with, I would say composure because you're kind of sneaking in, but I also think no one like is taking this as seriously as you are. And so it's going to be with reason instead.
Sure.
And so let's see how you do.
Okay. I got a 7.
A 7. Very good. I owe you a clue with a complication. Love that. We'll come back to that in a moment. Mr. Kessler.
Yes.
What are you doing as this game is going on? You're kind of like, some of the people there are like, you know, there's a protocol here, you know, there's a protocol of like, you know, asking for a game and like, you know, and it would be ungentlemanly to play for money, right? And all this kind of thing is kind of going on. So your presence is something of an annoyance at this point.
I assumed.
But you also have a certain inherent novelty that I think is difficult for people to completely cast aside. And so what are you doing? How are you keeping the crowd under control here? How are you keeping everybody on your side, if at all?
I think once I realize that nobody here wants action and they're not very interested in playing with me, I'm going to take one of the empty tables and just start making trick shots.
Nice. Good. I love it. At a certain point, one of the porters, wearing a very like finely tailored velour coat, comes up to you and says, excuse me, are you Mr. Kessler? That was a very good shot.
Thank you. Who's asking?
we have a resident here at the hotel who has her own suite of rooms, and she has invited you up.
Oh, what's her name?
Mrs. Brathwaite.
Of course.
Oh, well, that sounds lovely. I don't think they're really kind of picking up on my energy in here. So let's go see what that's about.
He'll kind of take you up and he says, Mrs. Brathwaite actually has a billiard table in her room.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Specially made. Yes. The velvet, sapphire blue.
And do you know how she knew I was here and what my name is by any chance?
He looks a little like kind of, he's got that look of like he's sort of like proud to know things, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And he says, well, Mr. Kessler, Mrs. Brathwaite is a very, very well-connected woman.
Oh, well, we should get along splendidly then.
She knows and sees a lot.
Very good. As do you, it seems. Lead the way.
You can go, he can catch the lift. That's a whole process. You eventually get up there. You get up to what is essentially like a semi-private floor. Like you make a right, and that's Theodora's side of the floor, right?
Mm.
And there's a little hall leading to a door that is the entrance to her suite. And there is standing outside the door a rather dour, solid, massive muscle standing there. And the bellhop says, isn't this exciting?
Yeah, it's a little intimidating. He's going to realize he didn't bring his weapons with him for this little trip. Yeah, but if she invited me, I mean, it'll be fine, right?
Oh, yeah, it'll be perfectly fine. Yeah, it'll be great. She's actually, for somebody who is so unimaginably wealthy, she's very, very down to earth.
Oh, that's great.
I think it's because she used to be a pirate.
Amazing. Yeah. So he'll start walking with a little more confidence toward the guard. And he'll take his hat off as he approaches. He wears his hat indoors. You're not supposed to, but, you know.
The bodyguard will open the door. And indeed, the room, this sort of suite of rooms, has been decorated entirely in Theodora's color. The wallpaper, the draperies, the pillows, all that stuff. Various shades of dark blue. And you hear the little clack of billiard balls coming from a side room. Come in, Mr. Kessler. grab yourself a drink. There's a bar cart right over there.
Without a word, he's preparing a whiskey for himself before he heads into that room.
Yeah.
Just for clarification, I don't think I've had any interactions with this woman.
No, I don't think you've ever met her, no.
Yeah, so he's going to pour two whiskeys and, you know, one for her and head into the room.
She's there. She's actually dressed. Normally, she's like in her like sort of blue gowns and hair done up. But now her hair is kind of down and she's wearing a beautifully tailored blue men's suit. As she takes her shot. And there's a few other people there as well. She has some guests, not just you.
Okay. He'll kind of stumble when he realizes that, and he'll say, sorry, I can go back and get drinks for everyone else. I just thought it was just going to be us. Ma'am, I presume you're Mrs. Brathwaite?
Theodora Brathwaite is my name, Mr. Kessler. And your first name is Roland?
Yes, Roland. Yes, that's right, ma'am. I love your suit. That is stunning.
Thank you. She kind of gives like a funny look to a pair of women in the corner who are also dressed in this like really kind of like butch way, you know, and they all give each other kind of like a little knowing look and a little nod and a wink. And then Mrs. Brathwaite says, so I hear you're looking for some action.
Yes. How did you hear? I was barely down there for what, 10 minutes before they sent that porter.
And again, there's this like knowing look among her and some of the other guests, and there's a little chuckle. They're all kind of in on something, Mr. Kessler.
Yeah, he's used to that feeling in London.
I'd like the night move just to keep your composure here. What are you afraid is going to happen if you don't?
I'm afraid that they brought him up here to embarrass him and maybe to get him barred from the hotel and prevent him from doing any investigating.
Okay. I have to say how it's worse than that. Mm-hmm. I'll take some recommendations from the table, though. Anybody have any thoughts on how this could go even more poorly for Mr. Kessler?
Maybe if Mr. Kessler loses his temper at this treatment enough, he'll let something of his wolfish side show.
Oh, I like that. That's pretty good. Yeah.
Damn it. That is good. Yeah.
You wolf out. I love it.
All right.
It's going to be with composure. I think because you're drained, I'm going to put you at a disadvantage as well.
Yeah. I thought you might. Okay, with composure, well, at least I have one in that. 6 plus 1, I have a 7.
Okay. We'll pick up the scene in a moment.
Okay.
Mr. Melmoth.
Hmm.
What's your approach for making contact with the ghost here?
Well, Sebastian isn't going to wait around at all. He'll just stride straight into the house. And look around, look out the door again, and then just call up the stairs and say, I do love what you've done with the place.
That's good. I think that there's not an immediate response, except that we have one of those moments where something goes plop, 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 you know, sort of changeling style, right? Down the stairs. Landing at your feet.
Yes.
And it's a coin.
Huh.
It's a very old coin. A very old coin that might have significance to you in some way, Mr. Melmoth. What is it?
Perhaps the head does look... It's difficult to tell because it's an old coin, but there's something about the profile that perhaps looks a little bit like Sebastian. But it's the tail side that shows what looks like the edifice of the theater that he goes to.
Ah, very good. I want the night move. What are you afraid is going to happen right now if you react badly to this?
We'll start gently here, I think. Sebastian's assumed that the ghost is going to want to speak to him. And I think Sebastian would be very upset if it just ignored him.
Oh, interesting. Well, it's got to be worse than that.
Hmm.
Furthermore, you will have to deal with the gentle ministrations of D.I. Pettigrew tonight as well.
Fantastic.
So if you'd like to go ahead and roll with sensitivity.
Of course.
And marked by the ghost, I'm going to put you at disadvantage too.
My sensitivity is nil, isn't it? Yeah, so that's 6.
Interesting. I have an idea for where this is going to go. And I think it's going to start like this. Mr. Melmoth, as you're looking at that coin, you hear outside the house, past the garden, past the gate, you hear D.I. Pettigrew talking to someone. Excuse me. What are you doing? Get your hands off of me. I'm from Scotland Yard. Someone is out there rough-handling D.I. Pettigrew. What do you do, Mr. Melmoth?
Hmm. Be ashamed to have such an incident pass by without an audience, so I'll go out and watch.
Very good. Ms. Innes, where do you head once you hit the waters?
I think I am headed to the location that we have narrowed down for our vampire and where they may be lodging. I want to see for myself.
I love it.
And I have to do something about it.
To resolve the threat, you have to either convince the vampire to leave London or you have to destroy it. So those are the options.
Mm-hmm.
We've established that there's this sunken boat, and it's all just sort of speculation on Hargrave House's part, but you speculate that the vampire might be nesting in an air pocket in a partially unsubmerged portion of the boat, right? And I think as you arrive at the boat underneath the water, you can probably see much better underwater at night than most other types of creatures, right? And we also established last time in the answering the question, you all surmised that there was a group of people who maybe were like aware of the vampire. Maybe they were passengers on the boat. Mm. Maybe they helped the vampire stay hidden. There might be some kind of connection, maybe.
That's right, yeah.
At this point, what I want to do is I want to paint a scene, and as we're looking through Miss Innes's eyes, everyone, what about this boat makes us think that the people who survived worshipped the vampire?
The threes, the like things in threes and the third one being completely like removed, there are instances of that where it looks like it was intentionally, something was intentionally crafted, like so like three little statuettes, the third of which is like smashed, but it looks like something that was done more ritualistically.
I think the sunken part of the ship is just surrounded by offerings, carved idols and coins and things like that they've dropped from the surface.
There is netting and also maybe just chains that are suspended off of weights that have been put to the bottom of the river around this boat, specifically to try and deter anyone else from being able to come across it or stumble upon it in a form of protection.
We'd determined, I think, that the worshippers, that these pilgrims were all fairly old. What's happened is, as some of them have died of old age or disease, they've just had themselves interred down here. Their bodies have been weighted with stones tied around their ankles, and there are these a few bloated, fish-eaten corpses just floating around the wreck like really grim party balloons.
Party balloons.
Ms. Innes, what do you do? What's your approach here?
Well, I think she's very careful as she approaches, just sort of eyeing all of these various offerings that have been made to this vampire and the way that these humans have worshipped it, she finds very intriguing. And it's not something that she hasn't seen before. I think there's many, many stories from many relatives as well and friends that she knows the intrigue that is easy to manipulate at times, but also fall in love with that humans will often offer to things that they don't understand. So I think she's approaching, though, not with the intent to hurt to begin. Like, she would like to find this space and ideally find this vampire to speak to them.
I want the night move just generally to infiltrate and locate the vampire. Okay. What are you afraid is going to happen if you fail?
What I'm most afraid of is that he'll just deem me a threat and attack me.
I think it's worse than that. I think that he will not just attack you, but he will drain you and will wear whatever is left of your skin. Ironically.
Yeah. Okay.
Go ahead and roll with composure.
Okay, so I think I'll need to use a mask.
What'd you get? What'd you get?
I got a 5.
I love it. We'll come back to this.
Great.
We'll narrate, and then you can decide whether you want to use a mask or not.
Okay.
I do want to check in briefly with Ms. Archer, and then we'll go back to St. Asana's. Ms. Archer, your clue. You jump the fence, which is kind of hilarious because I think it's a generally somewhat quasi-public place that anybody can walk around in.
Yeah.
And you jump the hedge, you jump the fence, and you end up on one side of the dancing pagoda. But underneath the sound of the music of the band, you hear another sound, another song, another voice. There is a little girl, maybe 12 years old, sitting on a stone bench along one of the little promenades, and she's singing a very strange song. It's a song you may have heard already in the vicinity of Cremorne Gardens, but it has a particularly eerie quality coming out of this little girl's mouth, and indeed it manages to cut through the noise of the dancing platform. And the little girl, when she sees you see her, she stops and she says, "The moon is bright tonight. Tonight's the best night to see what lies at the bottom of the river."
And where did you learn that lovely song?
Before she can answer, that's your clue, though, the existence of the girl singing the song. Before she can answer, you're both cut off by this loud, like, stomping, clumping sound. And what it is there's a group of dancers doing the can-can. And that's a really violent dance, right? Like pop, 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 you know, kicking their legs and slamming their shoes down and ruffling their skirts. And the can-can line has moved across the dancing platform so that it's pretty close to where you're at. And you see Ms. Welp. And she says, "Ms. Archer!" And she kicks up her leg and sends her shoe flying in your direction.
Can I go ahead and try to catch that just as slickly as possible? Just grab it out of the air?
You can and do. You're the legacy. You can, absolutely. And then she breaks away from the line and leans against the railing and says, "I wasn't sure if you were going to show up."
"I couldn't stay away, especially after letting you down last time. I believe this is yours. We'll hand the shoe up to her."
She says, "Not so easy. You're going to have to come find me to give it back to me." And then she presses into the crowd.
I think she looks at the little girl.
The little girl's gone.
Oh, well. All right. Okay. Viola's going to steel herself. She's going to just double check, pat the little places with all the weapons. Where are the blades? Okay, good. Let's go. And then into the fray. I think she'll go look.
I love it. Back to St. Osana's Scott. Millie Cooper cradles her young baby in her arms, softly murmuring stories of the baby's father, a man of noble blood. What do we learn of him?
Millie is there rocking her daughter Lizzie in her arms, singing her a lullaby. The lullaby does perhaps have certain strains in common with that song that we just heard the little girl singing to Viola. She's saying, "Oh, you are the very spit of your dad. Oh, he got his eyes. He got his beautiful green eyes. And, oh, he's such a handsome man. Such an handsome man. A man like him, a man of his breeding, would even look at a chambermaid like me. I felt like the most special girl on earth. And he'll come for us one day. It isn't his fault. His family made him do it. His family wouldn't understand. But he said he'd come for us someday and find a home for us and look after us and get us out of this place. He said he would one day. You just wait there, Lizzie. You just wait. He'll do right by us one day. One day.
I'm going to pick up with Mr. Melmoth, actually.
Hmm.
Mr. Melmoth, D.I. Pettigrew is outside the gate. He's being handled roughly by a trio of tough-looking people. The door to 18 St. James's Street softly clicks closed behind you, an indication that the ghost has no time for you this evening, I'm afraid. But D.I. Pettigrew, you know, he's sort of like, you know, unhand me, you know. And then he sees you and he says, Mr. Melmoth, these men, they've been following you. Run, Mr. Melmoth, run. Get your hands off of me.
I think you'll find a great many people follow me. What is it that makes these ruffians special?
Mr. Melmoth, I am obligated to protect you, to serve and protect you. You, as a citizen of this city, as a subject of the crown, I must, please, Mr. Melmoth, I shall handle this. But he's being overwhelmed by these three men. They're just like kicking the shit out of him.
I'll watch this for about 20, 30 seconds or so, and then eventually just raise a hand and say, "Excuse me, gentlemen, I do quite understand. D.I. Pettigrew can be a vexing character sometimes, and who amongst us hasn't wanted to beat him soundly around the face and neck? But I must ask why you are particularly moved to do this tonight."
I think you get your answer not from them, but across the way, across the street, opposite you, on the other side of the scuffle, another audience member. It's Winslow Taggart, that unfortunate and ill-mannered Pinkerton agent who came by Hargrave House a number of days ago looking for Mr. Kessler. I think these men are in the employ of Winslow Taggart.
Hmm.
I think they're just going to like basically knock out D.I. Pettigrew and then turn to you.
I'll leave them to that while they're distracted beating up D.I. Pettigrew and wander over towards Mr. Taggart.
Ah, very good. I like it. So just sort of walk past the scuffle, the melee. I like it. Good, good, good. We'll pick up with this in a moment. This is good. Ms. Archer. How is this going, Ms. Archer?
So the Archer family tries to groom its children for the roles, for specific roles, and the women in the family are schooled in the courtesies and customs of society with the expectation that they will at some point try to attract a mate, right? Someone to help provide more heirs. Wonderful stuff. So I think that she knows how to dance. Like, she knows dances. And, you know, she has certain kind of just athletic facility. So I think that she might be a decent dancer. She might be a very good dancer, actually.
Hmm.
Surprising everyone.
Yeah, and in the last like notes of a song stop, and everyone kind of laughs and claps as that song ends, and Ms. Welk says, "You're surprisingly light on your feet, Ms. Archer. I'm impressed."
That is very kind of you to say, and you as well. You seem to have had much experience on the dance floor.
Oh, I live for dancing. I know all of the dances, and I seek out new dances. I find my body just wants to be moved by the music, Ms. Archer.
Ah. And what else do you like your body to be moved by? No shame. No shame whatsoever.
At this point, she's kind of like discarded her coat. She's discarded her hat. Her hair's kind of like, you know, in a mess. She's kicked off her shoes to better move across the dance floor. And she says, "Well, I'm already half undressed, Ms. Archer."
Well, then let us see if we cannot finish this job. And I think that she'll like just like pull her in pretty close. Maybe the music is spinning up again and just will continue to try to break down this woman's defenses as much as possible.
I don't think there's any effort needed here.
Great.
Miss Welk is real down to get down right now. So
great.
She wants to end the evening with you.
Not fucking around at all. I don't suppose you happen to have a carriage here tonight, do you?
No, but we can certainly hire one, Ms. Archer.
I like that spirit, and I think that she'll start escorting her out of the gardens.
And as you are being escorted out of the gardens, you hear a scream from the dancing platform. A loud, ear-splitting scream.
If I turn around and cannot see anything from where we're standing, I think Viola would say to Miss Welk, "Please excuse me, I must see what is the trouble," and we'll head over to see what's going on.
When you rush back up to the dancing platform, you see the creature, the fish man, on the dancing platform. Now, whether it's a person in a costume, whether it's the creature itself, who can say? You're not close enough. But it's kind of hunkered down, kind of like, you know, like it's ready to leap. And it sort of does that like kind of Gollum scramble on all fours kind of walk thing. And it's just hissing and swiping big, you know, webbed paws or claws at people. You know, just doing its whole thing, just sort of. And you see a woman faint. You see a guy faint. There's just a lot going on, right?
Yeah.
What do you do?
Without even thinking, like instinct takes over. Viola's going to somersault kind of towards this. And as she's kind of tucked in, she'll reach into her boots and pull out Schattenlicht, and she'll start preparing to go after this. She's like heading directly for this creature.
As you lunge toward the creature, one of the dancers, just some big guy, he like intervenes and he says, "Madam, don't go near it. It's a monster." And he like grabs you, like tackles you to like stop you from advancing. What do you do?
Oh, I am so sorry, my dude. This is probably what some of the pins are for. She like adjusts something mechanical kind of on the bodice, and basically like where his arms are around her, he feels just like several pricks as these things kind of like shoot out and stab him in the arm in an attempt to like get him to release her.
I love it. Let's do the knight move. What are you afraid is going to happen if you fail?
I'm afraid that this idiot is going to prevent me from stopping this thing, and people are going to die.
Oh, boy. it's worse than that. I think he also accidentally injures you.
Motherfucker, this guy. Not now.
Roll with... I think it's, despite the way you've described it, I think it's still vitality. And if you want to keep going... No, I'm not going to make Albertina Welk be a problem here. You can roll with 2d6.
Thank you.
If she was still in the dancing platform, maybe, but.
Okay. Yeah, that's fair. Come on. Don't be an 8.
Oh.
We'll come back to the scene. Mr. Kessler, I think here you can trigger as cruel as the Harlot's Curse, if you'd like.
Oh, yes.
Since you're with Theodora and her unsavory friends.
They seem fine.
Unsavory by London polite society standards, anyway.
Sure. I guess they're up for gambling as well?
Of sure, absolutely. Yeah.
So I need to roll, what, with vitality?
Yeah, let's read the move. It says, as cruel as the Harlot's Curse, when you indulge your vice alone, meaning no other hunter, in the dark and seedy underbelly of London in order to deaden your senses, roll with vitality, please.
Okay.
And because of drain, I'm going to put you at disadvantage.
The whiskey makes it more dark and seedy in here.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, fuck. I rolled a 3.
What the hell?
A 3. Well. First of all, the pool playing is going really badly. Everyone is better than you.
Of course.
And so you've gotten so far behind that, like, you have just, like, moved to the periphery of the party as everyone else is kind of focused on the pool, right?
Yeah.
You've become a complete non-entity in the pool, as far as pool goes. And then, at a certain point, Mrs. Brathwaite comes up to you and she says, Mr. Kessler, are you all right? You seem a little dejected.
Yeah, it's just that, well, usually I play better than this. I think that the rules are a little different back where I come from.
Oh, Mr. Kessler, I do think you have perhaps one opportunity to redeem yourself.
Okay, I didn't know I quite needed that, but go on.
Oh, you certainly do need it, Mr. Kessler. And there's a laugh with a chuckle in the crowd. How about one-on-one, you and me?
Are we talking about billiards or?
Yes, Mr. Kessler, billiards.
Of course. Why not? My luck's got to change sometime, right?
If you win, I will crown you the king of the evening, and everyone shall celebrate your name from the distant reaches of that hallway right over there to right back here by the fireplace. Everyone will know your name. And there's more laughter.
Sounds like my 12th birthday party. Yeah.
In all seriousness, if you win, you will have beaten one of the best pool players in the city. And that's reward enough, don't you think, Mr. Kessler?
Yeah, I suppose it is.
If I win, I very much would like to know something. A little bit of information that you and your colleagues at Hargrave House are sitting on right now. And she gets really close to where only you and her can hear each other.
Yeah.
The vampire. You know where it's at in the city. And I don't mean Julius. I mean the older one.
Oh. Well, why not? I feel like we might have common goals here.
If I win, you tell me where I can find the vampire.
Okay. Yeah, it's a deal.